What do rodeo clowns, preachers, and talk show hosts have in common? Sheer volume, according to Kansas City artist Michael Schlefke, and that's why he's focused on these particular characters in his satirical paintings about the state of discourse in America today. I'm Gina Kaufman, and to kick off our first Friday art show on KCUR's Central Standard, Michael Schlefke is here to talk about his upcoming painting show, Don't Blow Your Big Top. Michael, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
I have serious questions about your opinion of talk show hosts.
Basically, it all boils down for me to Morton Downey Jr. and Wally George. So two old 1980s stalwarts of crazy, I guess, the first steps into where we are now.
Could you describe who those characters are for people who may not?
Yeah. Morton Downey Jr. was just a trash talk show host. He was set in New York. He set up, you know, like skinheads versus blacks and had the entire thing going and just would start fights. And he chain smoked with a pot of cigarettes on his desk. Wally George was a right wing conservative talk show host who had just blonde hair, blazing blonde hair, and had a poster of the space shuttle behind him that said USA's number one. And he ranted and raved and yelled at guests and threw them off the stage and everything. So,
okay, well, I feel better about your opinion of talk show hosts now. But let's start from the beginning. You have created more than 30 paintings centered around what you call the brash volume of American discourse today. And you've done that by portraying mostly rodeo clowns charging at bulls while draped in red, white, and blue. Talk to me about that image, rodeo clowns charging at bulls.
Okay, well, the rodeo clowns came out of a whole bunch of paintings I was doing about matadors. So I really liked the idea of like the imagery of a matador with the bull charging. And as I was working through those, I started getting tired of it. But then I found like I just kind of run through subjects and found rodeo clowns. And I loved the idea of American flag clad clowns running and getting chased by bulls. And I think there's two parts of that that really appeal to me. Is like, one, the image of that is outrageous. I think that sums up a lot of America today, is just like having people dressed in flags just running for their life like mad, getting chased by bulls, which could be stand-ins for just life, terrorism, fears, everything like that.
Just overall chaos?
Yeah, I think like the bull is like this, just this force of nature, basically, and just basically life in general. It could be whatever's coming, especially now with just like news cycles being 15 seconds at a time now, you know?
In this metaphor, though, the bull is the enemy you don't have to be fighting.
Well,
you know what I mean?
In my paintings, the bull plays a bunch of different roles, actually. With the rodeo clowns, I like that it's this out of force, you know, out of control force of nature. But also like the part of the rodeo clowns, the other part of the rodeo clowns that I really enjoy is that those guys are probably so American in their character that they are just these brave, almost kind of idiots that kind of run in front of a bull that's charging at them to save somebody else, you know? So it's like almost the best characters of America is like this bravery, willing to put yourself to help, you know, in trouble to help others. So there's just like this sense of just like that is like some of the peak characteristics, I think, of Americans. And then on the same end, you have this brash, you know, just on the surface, you see this brash guy just running in front of a bull like a crazed idiot, basically, you know? So I like those two ideas.
I want to make sure I understand this. So you're talking about two different opposing versions of what you think of as like the pinnacle of Americanness, which is an extreme helpfulness. Mm-hmm. And an extreme, what would be the other word? Is it, because you've used the word idiot a couple of times.
Well, just kind of like a brash, like stepping in without thinking. I think there's really kind of like, it's two sides of a coin, you know? So you have the good and the bad. And I think like, and the bad isn't even bad. It's just, it's entertaining. It can be entertaining. That's why I watched Morton Downey in those shows, because it was really funny to me to watch that out of control craziness. And realizing that it was a TV show and wasn't real life, basically. And the idea of like the rodeo clown running into this situation is an amusing idea. It's entertainment, you know? So there's this end of American culture basically that basically boils down to we're just entertainers almost.
The titles of your paintings carry a lot of meaning. Can you talk to me about a few titles and what they mean to you?
Sure. One of them, actually, I just titled it the other day, is TV Killed the Rodeo Star. So I have a whole painting. It's a large 4-foot by 6-foot painting of with Morton Downey Jr., rodeo clowns. He's yelling at a guest. There's rodeo clowns running through the painting. There's a bull charging through the painting. There's a street preacher in there. And I kind of just feel like that whole mix of everything in there is just kind of our time, you know, our attention span and time right now with how things go.
Volume is this recurring theme, and it's something that would be very hard to communicate in paintings. It's not visual, and that intrigues me.
I think volume can be put into a painting with, like, brush marks. I think, like, the way it's painted, the actual act of painting itself can kind of create that volume in a picture. So I feel that my stuff is loose enough where it has the gestures and the marks, and you can kind of see there's a quickness and motion and that. And I think that relates to sound in a way, you know?
For all the seriousness of the topic you're examining, like the state of discourse in America today, the paintings in Don't Blow Your Big Top have really an appearance of fun. They look fun.
Sure. And, you know, I think that's the tough situation of being a painter now and being someone who looks at politics and looks at life and tries to put it down, is that I don't want to be Debbie Downer and go, here's this horrible thing and this is how it is. And but life...
Why not?
Well, one, I don't want to be that guy. but then also, I think, like, you know, there is... Art has its own sense of beauty, and I think life is fun and entertaining. And, like, I always try to look at life first with humor, and I think that... So even looking at horrible things, I'll joke about that to a degree, you know?
Playfulness does seem key in your work overall. You once organized a game show-themed exhibit, which was presented as an actual game show?
Yeah, about 3 years ago, 2 years ago now. I've put together a lot of group shows, and they usually have themes, and I'll get a bunch of artists to kind of start with that theme and run in their own direction. So the last one I put together was the game show, and so I had about 25 artists make game show-themed artwork, and then I ended up building kind of a Price is Right type set of game shows that were all involved with art, and I ended up putting on a wig and becoming the game show host, with audience members being the people playing the game show the whole night of the show.
You also organized something called the Danger Derby in Austin.
Yeah, that was another crazy wild event that just kind of happened. So I'd done a bunch of these shows, and they were pretty well renowned and won awards and all, but so a couple of my friends came to me. They had a studio in East Austin. They wanted to do some big event during the East Austin studio tour, which was the citywide open studios. And so it's like, well, it's got to be more than an art show. So I brainstormed with a few friends, and I came up with the idea to do a Pinewood Derby race like the Boy Scouts, but, like, let everybody build a car. So artists could build a car, people could build a car. We gave everyone 2 weeks to build a car. So a lot of people made art cars. They made unicorns. Some people put subs on it, a beer can. I sculpted Miley Cyrus twerking on one once, and then we'd run them down a 100-foot track with danger. So we used, like, cartoonish violence to kind of destroy the car. So we had a swinging anvil and a fire pit and saw blades and everything. So it was a super event.
You don't seem, from what I'm hearing, like someone who minds spectacle.
No. And I mean, that goes back to talk shows too. Like the spectacle of Morton Downey and Wally George and all those guys yelling and crazy. I mean,
present company accepted.
Sure. Yeah. Talk shows, I always throw it back to those particular guys.
Yeah.
When I lived down in Austin, I had met Alex Jones. And when I lived in Austin, he was looked at as the city clown. You know, like, we all just looked at him and was like, oh, that's the guy ranting and raving. The first time I was ever in Austin, we stayed at the Austin Hotel and put on Community Access. And there he was, red-faced, yelling about George Bush and 9/11 with 9/11 on the green screen behind him going on actively. And nobody took him seriously. And then all of a sudden, 15 years later, he's advising the president on matters, which is insane. So that's the trick, is like, how do you keep the spectacle and not turn it into where it gets into that place?
So out of curiosity, where in Kansas City is your studio?
It's in Northeast Kansas City.
How do you think your surroundings impact your work? I mean, the Northeast has a very specific vibe. And as far as, like, volume in our culture. I feel like it's a very quiet part of Kansas City in the sense that when you think about who's shouting the loudest, I feel like that's a quiet part of the city in that sense.
I love it because it's quiet. And so I need quiet when I work, and I don't need craziness going on at all. So I do appreciate the neighborhood is quiet, and my studio is quiet. I'll have music on, but it's always secondary and in and out. But the neighborhood itself is wonderful. I'm going to paint a mural of the map of the Northeast on the side of the building where my studio is, which is going to be cool.
As you've worked on the Don't Blow Your Big Top series, American discourse has continued to prove weird and in some ways probably gotten even weirder than when you began.
Just today, Trump is going to read. So he's going to read the Ukraine correspondence. So that's going to happen.
But I mean, I guess my question is, has working on these particular paintings while absorbing the news and being part of this culture, has that given you a perspective that you might not have had if you were watching passively without simultaneously painting America through the lens of rodeo clowns?
You know, it has changed things. I mean, like, it's been, I always think of like my shows as kind of like an album where like I have my hits, I have some B-sides, I have, you know, filler, I have stuff, but it's all related to one theme and one subject at the time I'm painting stuff. And then it's kind of like I produce that show, that's my album, and I move on. So this whole thing, it's always a meditation on what the theme is. And it really has made me look at, because I love game shows, I love infomercials, I love people yelling from the sidelines. My favorite Shakespeare characters are the Fool, and, you know, like, I love that aspect of things. The guy standing on the sideline making the comments that should be basically in the middle ground. So I love all that, and it really has changed. Like, it's made me think of how I reacted to those shows as a child and all.
Michael Schlefke, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Don't Blow Your Big Top opens next Thursday, November 7th at the Foundation Event Space in Kansas City's West Bottoms. I'm Gina Kaufman, and in just a minute, we'll hear from a Kansas native who's headed home with a new book. It's called Kansastan, and it's pretty mind-blowing. Stay tuned for more on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and my next guest is a guy by the name of Farouk Ahmed. He lives in L.A., but he's from Kansas, Leawood to be specific, and his acclaimed new novel, Kansastan, is in part a working through of the reactions he gets as a brown-skinned person when he tells people he's from Kansas. Kansastan is smart, funny, poignant, lyrical, playful, and reading it is an experience unto itself. We'll talk about all of that, but let me welcome the author, Farouk Ahmed. It's great having you.
Thank you so much for having me, Gina, and thanks for that introduction.
Can you set up the plot of Kansastan for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. The plot of Kansastan is this idea. It's sort of inspired by the American Civil War and set roughly at the time of Bleeding Kansas in the pre-Civil War era when Kansas and Missouri were a microcosm for what was eventually going to happen in the Civil War. In it, I have placed a group of Muslims, one of whom is the narrator, who believes that the Kansans should really be going after the Missourians more. And indeed, by the end of the novel, not to give too much away, the Kansans do indeed go after the Missourians and attempt to take over the part of part of Missouri that's along the Missouri River to rectangularize the state, as it were.
Yeah, the Missouri is called the imperfect edge of our near-perfect rectangle.
That's right.
I really loved that. You know, okay, so, but what we haven't really gotten into is that the characters populating this world you're describing are not the, you know, white pioneers of legend in America.
No, absolutely not. It's my attempt to insinuate Muslims in specific into that cultural landscape, into that land, in that physical landscape as well. And, you know, there are many reasons for that, one of which is that we think of Islam in particular as a recent kind of invention or invasion, as it's been called, into the U.S. But Muslims have been in the States since, you know, at least the first slaves arrived. We know that a good percentage of them were also Muslim. And that history, of course, has been quite literally whitewashed. But they were there. And I suppose in this way, and having grown up in Kansas and having grown up, you know, with state line a block away, it was my attempt to really put us in there.
The dedication at the beginning of the book sets the tone. It's ostensibly meant to be from the narrator, the main character, as opposed to you, the author. But it says, "For my cousin Faisal, would that he had lived a shorter life."
Yeah, it is. I would say it's a little bit. I do have a cousin, Faisal, and who also actually attended high school in Blue Valley here in Kansas. And I don't think he's particularly happy with that inscription, but it is.
So it is from you, the author.
It is from me, the author, but it's also really from me, the author, as narrator. And I think that's the narrator character. And that is really where the blurring of the personal and the political and the personal and the fictive begin. It's from that first line of the book.
Talk to me about the style you've written in. How would you describe it?
That's a good question, because I think the language in this book is one that is certainly not period, though it is inspired by period language. And what I've essentially done is taken period language, or my attempt at period language, and infused it with a kind of first generation English learner's perspective on that language, and then sort of filtered that through the translations of the Quran that I grew up with. And a lot of those translations were written a long time ago, and so they use a almost older style of English. So it's been inspired by period language, but very much filtered through a first generation English language learner with some Quranic sort of higher minded language thrown in.
I have a passage I want you to read. I believe it's been sent to you today. You're in LA, so I can't just hand
That's
it to
right.
you.
No, I do have it.
So set it up as you, whatever you think people need to know about where we are in the plot at this point, and then begin with, "I persevered."
Okay. So this is a passage from the earliest part of the book. I think it's from the first chapter. And basically in it, the narrator, who is an orphan boy, is on the back of a cattle cart, and he's being led to the mosque in which he's going to reside.
And I should say, he's surrounded by dead people because he has been mistaken for such a dead person.
That's right. He is bandaged. He has been thrown in the back of a cart surrounded by dead bodies who are presumably casualties of this Kansas-Missouri infighting, and he is being led along with them to at the time he doesn't know it's in the location, but he'll be living in the minaret of this mosque. All right, I'll go ahead.
Yeah.
"I persevered. This is, after all, a story of my perseverance in the face of familial, sectarian, and international persecution, in that order. Above us hovered the fat form of a warship blimp. A golden braid trailed from it like the tail of a kite. Not Missourians. I pointed at the dirigible and asked the squirrel-faced drover if he saw it. He glanced upward, any response a victory of a sort. Then he scowled. His disgust was more terrifying than his amusement, and he returned to his mute ways. I rested my bandaged head on my valise. Inured to the bucking of the cart, I drifted off, watching the flame that trailed the blimp. A blast! Missourians! Roused me. Their bombs infallible at waking even a dwale-drunk jayhawker. I searched the skies for that blimp. Where was it? Gone. I would think about that blimp often enough to believe that I could summon it. The sun had outrun us, too. It roosted ahead like a blazing buzzard. It reminded me of a line from Scripture. Enjoy yourselves, for your destination is the fire. It should be said that only on a rare occasion did the good book console rather than torment me. This was not one of those occasions."
Farouk Ahmed, Talk to me about how the legacy of the American Civil War here on the Kansas-Missouri border lives in your mind, in your imagination, as someone who grew up here.
You know, growing up in Kansas, I feel like we were fortunate to get at least the Kansas side of the Civil War. And of course, there's so much Civil War history in the area. You don't have to go outside of Kansas City to experience it. And what really got me was studying the Bleeding Kansas period and that pre-Civil War period. And I think as we grew up and grew older and learned about these types of border wars that are political usually in nature, rather than religious specifically, I saw a lot of resonances between what was happening in the Bleeding Kansas period to all sorts of conflicts that you see now that are essentially border wars, whether it's Israel-Palestinian, you see what's happening with the Turks and the Kurds right now. And so I was really looking at that period of Kansas as a reflection of all of these other border wars that are happening and how they reflect the political realities at the time. Obviously, like the Bleeding Kansas stuff started after the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which sort of invalidates the Missouri Compromise, which then leads to an influx of people, both from, you know, the New England who are anti-slavery, and then, of course, pro-slavery Missourians who are funneling into Kansas and trying to set it up with their own politics in mind.
You know, I have to say that in our time, it can be very easy for people living outside of the places that are typically seen as sites for conflict along borders, sites for conflict among sects of various religions, to shake their head in disbelief at the violence and conflict and tensions around borders that they see on the news. And I do feel like in some way you're saying this is America's story too.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, probably in America, we have never been so acutely aware of our divisions as we are now between the Republican-Trump administration and seeing pretty much the rest of us. You know, in a lot of ways, the problems that we have in America have still been codified from that Civil War time. We're wrestling over different issues. And, you know, certainly there has been a lot less physical violence, though there has been physical violence in the U.S. And it really, we really are grappling with these issues. And let's just hope our democracy is strong enough to withstand them this time.
You know, your perspective on the Kansas landscape, the prairie, the limestone or rock chalk is really thought-provoking. I will just say I love Willa Cather, but when I read your character's story of arriving in a cart on the prairie in a bandage, and it's very gruesome, like there's blood, and it's very the physical hardship of that form of travel, which does kind of mirror, you know, came here in a covered wagon kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I feel a contrast between the way you choose to describe it, which is through this really like stuff like drinking from a stream alongside an injured cow while someone else pees in that stream. It is not the majestic blanket of grass with endless sky that makes you feel small in kind of a spiritual way, which is so totally what readers of prairie literature have been trained to expect.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, definitely Cormac McCarthy, I think, is a huge inspiration and a huge stamp on the way that I viewed this, looking at landscape, for example. And, you know, the other thing I think was growing up, I had I was fortunate to travel in the Middle East. And one of the things that really impressed upon me was this idea that these vast open spaces, whether they are in the middle of the desert or they're in the middle of the prairie, can be really, you know, hell to traverse. And there are hardships that are faced even in absolutely beautiful lands. And the other thing that really inspired me is the fact that both of these lands are religious. They provoke, you know, religious feelings, deeply religious feelings. Certainly the expansion of the American West, I don't think would have happened without that religious notion, without that religious fulfillment that America needed to be a whole country. And with and you know, going to the West was a huge part of that. And so I think those desires to mirror the Middle East and the Midwest are there in the novel. The hardships faced while travel are there in the novel, and they reflect, you know, hardships in both areas. But occasionally you do have these beautiful things that, that happen that save you. There's a stream. There is a house that might be there to save you in the rain. There are these copses of forest that you can hide in that are lush and beautiful. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to grow up in Leawood, southern Leawood, when it was still transitioning from farmland into the sprawling suburb that it is now. And, you know, I remember playing in areas that were completely forested over or then were completely still covered in, you know, rows of corn. And definitely those both delights and hardships influence the view of landscape in the novel.
There is, you know, speaking of religion, this recurring idea of exhaling as you say something, which I had to look up because I didn't know what it referenced, and I'm intrigued by it. I will not claim that having Googled it, I am now an expert, but I guess when you recite from the Quran, there's some significance to not breaking your breath.
Yeah, wow. That was good research. I'm
Thank
so
you,
impressed
Google.
When no, I'm really like I'm so pleasantly surprised when people who have read the book try to find those references, because I feel like, you know, I did some work to put them in there. So thank you, Gina, for pulling that out. Yeah, absolutely. There is this notion that when you are saying the first line of a prayer, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, you're supposed to say it all in one breath, usually as an exhalation, though not necessarily.
And I'm also interested in a lot of phrases beginning with "would that."
Yeah, that's a little harder for me to explain because there's no easy answer. I think that really comes from the narrator's desire to shape the world in a different way. Would that my cousin had lived a shorter life? He really wishes to impose himself on this landscape, in this religion. He really wishes to capture the interest of the followers for himself. And eventually he does that in his own devious ways. But it really stems from this desire of a powerless person trying to wish himself into situations or wish the world was different than it is.
I'm talking to Farouk Ahmed, the author of Kansastan. Farouk, take me to where you were in your own life when you started writing this book.
Yeah, that was a little easier to answer, but emotionally a little bit more charged, in the sense that I started what ended up being the short stories that created this novel. The idea for this novel was really born out of a shift in perception that I experienced in post September 11th Manhattan. I was living in New York City, in Lower Manhattan, for several years before September 11th happened, and I had the misfortune of starting grad school really within a few weeks before September 11th happened. And one of the reasons that I had gone to New York was, like many people, seeking a kind of not necessarily a new identity, but being able to dissolve into the background, I think, was nice for a while, you know, not being a brown person in a white space necessarily, but just being another person on the subway is a kind of a beautiful idea. And post September 11th, let's just say that things changed. Every time I walked into the subway, people would, you know, scowl at me or, you know, grab themselves to protect themselves in some way. It was really a bizarre flip in my own personal circumstances. And certainly, you know, that was the exact opposite of what I wanted when I had, you know, chosen to live in New York City. And so, and then of course, you know, all the Islamophobia, all the anti-Muslim stuff began post September 11th. Certainly it continues on now, depending on political whims primarily. And so I think for me, the reason, part of the reason that this narrator character in this novel is who he is, was very much an internalization of this kind of anti-Muslim rhetoric and this hate that had been spewed both verbally and physically onto my person and to, of course, many other millions of Muslims in this country. And so to really digest that, I think I had to embrace it in a way and create a character who was desirous of power in a way that all these Islamophobes said we were, who was duplicitous in a way that all of these Islamophobes said we were. And that became a lot of the impetus for at least this character in this novel.
Yeah, talk to me about the significance of this main character being, as you put it, crippled. I mean, crippled is the term you use in the book. It's what the narrator calls himself. It's not the word I would typically use to describe someone in his condition, but yeah, go talk to me about that.
Well, so of course, you know, the narrator for has leg braces, and these leg braces eventually to help him walk, and eventually they feature in a kind of a revivalism that his cousin, the new prophet, does. He becomes healed. But calling him a cripple is both a reflection of what he would have been called at the time. He would needing these devices to walk, but also, you know, just on a real personal level, when I grew up, I had severely bowed legs, and so I was given these at a young age, and it really helped me connect the character's emotional cripple with his physical cripple, being a cripple, and also tapped into the feelings that I had felt growing up when I had these very same leg braces that we later found out were like not necessary kind of thing.
You know, he's so this main character who you see different aspects of yourself in, both the you see the way people you thought might be perceiving you in post September 11th America. You saw your own childhood and some of the struggles that you actually did experience as a child. And you're sort of working through all of these things. This character is in some ways likable, and in some ways you're laughing at him because he's funny. But also, you do feel empathy for him. You've mentioned that he was orphaned, and there is this passage where he writes about hearing sort of like the whispers of souls in the wind and imagining that they're his parents. It's really unexpectedly heartbreaking in the context of this very funny sort of, this very funny, not quite emotional narrative.
Thank you for that. I don't know that I could have put that any better than you just did. I mean, I think regardless of how you approach a character, if there isn't some way that you are emotionally rounding that character out, helping that character and in turn, I think, helping yourself with that character's immediate and of course, long-term kind of problems, you're not really creating a character. And I think you're right. There are definitely aspects of this character that you are laughing at and you should be laughing at. And there are definitely aspects of this character that are horrific and are inspired by horrific things and this desire for power. But, of course there's an emotional component, and of course there are things that he really wishes he could change that aren't power grabs, that are about his past. And I think, you know, as we approach the world in a way, there are these horrific characters around us, and they do have this weird emotional core that, you know, you wish you could reach, or you wish that they could reach and heal themselves in a way. This is not a character who does that, but I think any character would be remiss without trying to at least figure out that level of depth.
Something we really haven't discussed, which is how I began this conversation with you, is that when you tell people you are from Kansas, you get a certain kind of reaction, and that's part of what you were seeing as fertile territory for you, as someone who is going to reach readers, not just with direct personal experience of Kansas and Missouri, as most of our listeners have, but a lot of people who have a very particular kind of idea of who is in Kansas.
You know, I think I never would have thought that growing up in Kansas, while I was growing up in Kansas, would be such fertile ground necessarily. But, you know, for many of us who have left the state, it's so weird because there is this notion that, like, Kansas specifically kind of, like, lives in an anachronistic time where it just is devoid of any progress. It's, like, completely rural. There's, like, no industry there. Is there an airport? Do you ride tractors? And I think what was especially weird for me, you know, I've lived on both coasts. I'm in L.A. now. I used to live in New York, but grew up in Kansas. And what was, I think, especially weird for me was that my parents emigrated from India, from central India to central U.S., right, in Kansas. And whenever I had left the state, people were as surprised, as shocked, maybe even more so, that I grew up in Kansas and then had, like, left Kansas as well, you know, that kind of thing. So there is so much in the American imagination, and certainly the Wizard of Oz thing is part of that. But even beyond that, there is this kind of, like, willful naivete of people's expectations of what Kansas is. And I just think, as, you know, as a creative person, as a writer, playing with those expectations, it's kind of just a wonderful place to be. It's a blank canvas in a lot of ways.
What do you hope readers take from this experience? Because it's not a speedy read. It takes work. You don't breeze through reading Kansastan.
No, you absolutely do not. I hope readers get... I hope readers enjoy, although enjoy is, it's a tough book at parts, so I don't know if enjoy is the right word. But I do hope that readers come across this sense of language. They get enveloped in it. They see some of the parallels, at least, between what is going on now and what was going on in the past. They get a connection. They learn about some of these Islamic stories. One of the things that we haven't talked about is, I think, the influence that a lot of these Islamic stories that I grew up with, we don't hear about and we don't think about in popular culture, and as much as we do, obviously, the Christian versions of these stories. But there are Islamic versions of these stories, like the story of the well, the finding the well, is very much taken from the way that Makkah was formed as a city, and that it was a fresh water source, and there was this miraculous well. And a lot of the Abrahamic stories are also there in the Quran, which inspire it. So, yeah, I mean, I hope people get that experience.
Farouk Ahmed, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina.
Farouk Ahmed is a Kansas native. He describes his background as Indian, Shia, Muslim, Kansan American, and his new book is Kansastan. He'll be home for a reading at Prospero's November 10th. I'm Gina Kaufman, Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And last time we had Edgar Galicia on this show, he was talking about a shooting that had just taken place on his beloved Central Avenue, a street that's home to tight-knit communities with bustling commerce, a street people care about, a street where people live, work, and perhaps most importantly for our purposes today, a street where people celebrate. The annual Day of the Dead parade along Central Avenue is tomorrow, and we're going to hear what's in store and whether this year will be any different. Edgar Galicia with us from the Central Avenue Betterment Association. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so happy to be here talking to you about a parade.
Yes, yes.
The parade is actually the culmination of a day's worth of festivities. What will people experience if they head to Central Avenue tomorrow, starting in the early afternoon?
First of all, they're going to see a lot of color, a lot of happiness, and the community coming together in numbers.
What else?
Well, the program is very interesting. This is our third year in a row that we produce this festival. And this celebration has brought the community together really, really strong. We will have at 2 p.m., we will have face painting, the Calavera face painting. Last year, we had a lot of people that didn't get to be painted. So we are increasing our production by 2 hours. So people get there early and really get into the atmosphere.
So that that becomes part of the costume.
Exactly, exactly. Exposing your skeleton is part of accepting what is there for us and that we have another life, another level of expressing.
Yeah, can you explain what Day of the Dead is about on a cultural and spiritual level for those who aren't familiar?
Right. So the best way I have found to say it clearly is that Day of the Dead is our Memorial Day, just with the Mexican color and spice. You know, it's all about the memory of our loved ones and respecting and honoring their presence.
In a fun way.
In a very fun way.
Tell me about the fun.
Well, so we are going to have Catrinas, which are ladies that are all dressed up in very, very classy and beautiful garments with their beautiful makeup. And they are going to be walking around. And we have some special people there participating that are really part of the community and have enhanced the outreach of our community. And they will be walking around. And so we are going to have food, an enormous amount of food from different restaurants. We're going to have patios where you can get a table and enjoy the day from that table back and forth. We will have live music. We have 5 stages of singers and dancers. We will have, obviously, the fantastic parade that has gone from 12 floats the first year to almost 40 floats this year. We have a big number of horses that will be in special painting and colorful outfits all over the place.
Costumed horses?
Yes,
custom
horses.
I love it. Tell me about the horses. Where did this idea come from?
So with technology comes neon and these lights that are garment for the horses. And so they get painted in different colors and accompanied with the lighting. And it's a night parade, so it's all going to be shining, very beautiful.
Glowing in the dark.
Glowing in the dark.
Tell me about some of the music that people will hear. I know that as someone who's been involved in organizing all of this, you're probably excited for all of the music. But tell me about one performance that you think, if someone's going to time their arrival just to catch a certain performer, like where would you recommend they land?
Oh, my God, that's a hard one. Because we have literally 7 blocks of activity. And we have 5 stages along the avenue that will have performers on stage from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the same time. So nobody will miss the fun. No matter where you are walking on the avenue, you will see the performers, you will hear the music, you will be able to get some food and artifacts and be part of it.
Okay, I won't make you be the parent picking your favorite child. I will just say, randomly out of the hat, pick a band to tell us about.
So we have Perla Portales, who is a beautiful singer that it is her expertise are Mexican folk music. She has a beautiful voice, so she will be there somewhere between 13 and Central. But then we have a radio station bringing a Katrina contest at the same time. So you will see all of these beautiful ladies dressed up in costumes, Day of the Dead costumes, Katrinas, and they'll be showing off, you know. We have Sheira Reyes. We have the Rosemary's Fiesta Mexicana dancers.
Tell me about them.
Well, so Rosemary is a lady that has been working for the community for the last 40 plus years. And she encouraged good behavior and community building through dancing and has had a dance club for all this time.
What kind of dance?
Mexican folk music. And so they come in with all the dressed and outfits and makeup and beautiful hair, and they will be performing at Bethany Park, we have an offering park that we're building. There will be performing.
Offering park. Can you explain that?
Yes, of course. We have invited the families or members of our community to come together and celebrate their loved ones. And obviously, for Day of the Dead, the key family's hold is the offering to our loved ones, where we put on a table their favorite food, their favorite drinks, their favorite artifacts, their pictures. So we are inviting everybody to come and build one for their families.
Anyone who wants to and build an offering to their family and loved ones.
Obviously, we want our community to participate, but we have no borders. We invite everybody. We don't see colors or shapes or nothing. You want to be part of it, come and enjoy.
You said that this is the third year that Central Avenue has hosted this Day of the Dead parade. Can you talk to me a little bit about what inspired you that first year to get this underway?
So we have a mentoring program during the summer, and students from junior and senior high school years come and work with us about learn about leadership. They get to see all of the structure for the community, the government, how everything functions. And in all this discussion, we started talking about how to celebrate and the community and how it's important to build pride and community. And we asked them what would they like to do in order to bring more of that. So they talk about Cinco de Mayo. They talk about the different holidays that would bring community together. And all of them agree that Day of the Dead is something that is far-reaching, more spiritual than just a let's have drinks and party type of thing. And so it is very festive. It is family involvement, colorful. And so at that moment, they said, we would help you with the production. Obviously, the production has gone beyond that conversation, and we now have a close to 10,000 visitor event.
That is pretty crazy. When I think about just going from nothing to a big citywide event like that in 3 years' time, did it surprise you? Do you think that you were tapping into something that people really were craving and needing?
Absolutely. And this is not the stop of it. We are working in partnership with the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art and other organizations in the metro to bring Day of the Dead weekend, where we have a whole Friday, Saturday, and Sunday events around the metro concentrated or purposely set where we can celebrate our loved ones.
Do you have, as this event has grown over the last 3 years, is there a certain aspect of it that speaks to you personally that you find yourself going into year three like this? It's just what you are looking forward to, what you kind of dream about when you picture yourself there.
You're sending me back about 45, 50 years in my memory, because I do remember these times being very, very fun, family-oriented. But
as a kid?
Yes, working in the community. So I come from a town in Mexico City that is on the outskirts. And back then, we would go to the farm and harvest corn and pick wood and do a bonfire outside and invite all friends and build the offering in the living room. And so it was very, very lived, very full of color. And my personal memories are really strong about that. No lie, that's why I love this event and this celebration. But everybody embraces it in a way that makes it theirs. And that's what I love about it. There is no one in the whole world that doesn't have an angel looking over us.
Edgar Galicia, thank you so much. Where can people find more information about everything happening along Central Avenue this weekend?
Absolutely. You can visit the kavakck.org website, or go straight and directly to dayofthedeadweekend.com.
Our time is up. You can get everything we talked about this morning at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard, and it'll be ready for you by the end of the day. That's not just it for today. That's it for the week on Central Standard. But you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST, and we love chatting with our listeners. So if there's something that's on your mind that you hope we might discuss too, let us know when we'll talk to you about it. At KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, Noah Taborda, and Ann Kniggendorf, who is signing off as a Central Standard producer today, and we really appreciate her for everything she's done. Thank you, Anne. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Have a great weekend.